Bill, the floor is yours.
Okay, thanks, Harley. I appreciate it. I'm really pleased to be able to speak today on this topic. I saw Harley coming down the hall a few months ago, and I was not quick enough to dive into an adjacent office. So he spotted me and asked me to speak, and actually I'm happy to do it. Since we've announced, you know, we did a press release when we announced the expanded level of collaboration with SpaceX. Also answered a bunch of media questions, but this will go into a little bit more detail about what NASA's role is in this. So just to set everybody's expectations, that's what I'm going to be talking about today primarily, is what NASA's role is in this. I have some details about the Red Dragon mission itself, but the focus will be on what we're doing. And that is because our role in the mission, NASA's role, is somewhat limited. We don't have full insight into the overall mission design, nor should we. The way I like to characterize our role is we're kind of like a consultant to SpaceX. Our commitment is relatively small compared to the overall commitment from SpaceX, and we're providing very specific areas of expertise, and I'll describe each one of those. I do have some details about the mission, but for you know, if you guys want detailed questions, those are probably best addressed to SpaceX. So I'll be moving on now to slide two. This is a background slide. This really started with the what's called the Collaborations for Commercial Space Capability. What I noticed probably in around 2012, 2013 was there was an increased number of private sector entrepreneurial space companies that were emerging, many of which were, like I said, entrepreneurial ventures that weren't necessarily seeking the U.S. government funding and weren't targeting the U.S. government as one of their primary primary customers. And what we had also found from our experience with both commercial cargo and commercial crew was that companies that partner with NASA, even on an unfunded basis, receive significant benefits from our interaction and collaborations with them. Our experience, our lessons learned, our expertise, this was very, very valuable, not necessarily the funding, and we had a number of unfunded agreements that are less well known in both cargo and commercial crew, and we were getting feedback from those partners that they were really benefiting from these partnerships. So I had the idea a few years ago was to go out with this call, and the goal of the CCSC agreements was to advance private sector development of space capability so that emerging products and services would be or potentially could be available to government and non-government customers within approximately 5 years. So that was the goal, and it was really mutually beneficial. On the part of the companies, it advanced their capabilities, it strengthens the U.S. industrial base, and hopefully will increase the likelihood that these products and services would be available to us in the future. If you think about it, NASA could develop every capability that we need. Obviously, that would be a very expensive proposition. Another way to go about doing it is just to leverage what's available in the private sector and to increase the likelihood and the number of capabilities that are available to NASA. We thought it would be a good idea to enter into some of these unfunded agreements with the private sector.
Hey, Phil?
Yeah.
Do you anticipate NASA doing this again?
Well, I can't speak for all of NASA. I can say within HEO, that's the mission directorate that I'm in, the Human Exploration and Operations Mission Directorate, we do have an on-ramp clause to the CCSC agreement. So we wanted to leave that possibility open in the future, that if we saw that there were a significant number of additional companies that didn't necessarily have the opportunity to bid back in 2013 when we made the original announcement, that we could go out again for an additional call. I can say right now I don't have any plans to do that, but the possibility to do that is still available through the on-ramp clause.
Thank you.
Yeah. I can say that we received over 20 responses from industry to our call, and they went through a fairly competitive, rigorous evaluation and selection process, and we ended up choosing four. These are no exchange of funds agreements. Each party bears their own cost of participation. From NASA's standpoint, one of the things that we used was it had to have a tie to strategic plan objective 1.1. That's HEO's strategic plan objective, and that is to expand human presence into the solar system and to the surface of Mars. So it had to have a tie, it had to have a benefit to HEO, and we used that as part of our selection process, as well as the viability of the concept and, to some extent, the viability of the companies themselves. All those went into the selection process.
Phil, this is Carly. Plank moderator here. Let me remind folks, I hear background noises, background speaking. Folks, everybody make sure that your microphone is muted. So apologies, Phil, please continue.
Yeah, no problem. And like I said, these are no exchange of funds, and each party bears its own cost. So obviously there are some costs. We make it's mainly people, right, and our expertise. We also provide documents upon request that are internal to NASA, but it's mostly labor, and we cover the cost of our own, the labor that we provide to our partners. That was funded with some leftover money from COTS. When we finally finished off COTS in, I guess it was 2013, and we wrapped that all together, not only was it a very cost-effective or spacecraft development effort, but we ended up having $2 to $3 million left over. This was money that was appropriated for partnerships. So when I got this idea, it all made sense. We had all these new entrepreneurial companies. We could see the value both to NASA and to the companies themselves from this kind of collaboration. And we had some very, very limited funds to implement some of these partnerships. So that's why we did it. And again, we do have the on-ramp clause that I mentioned. So back to the slide, you can see the four that we chose, SpaceX. No surprise to everybody that SpaceX has some Mars aspirations. Back then, there wasn't a specific mission. It was just sort of this general goal that SpaceX had towards Mars. So if you look at the original agreement, which is online, all the original agreements and the amendments are online. You can take a look at them. It's fairly broadly worded. Towards Mars and Mars technologies and system development. Then there was, this is a typo, this is Orbital, ATK. Originally it was Orbital, and then of course it was they had the merger, so now it's Orbital ATK. I don't know what happened to the word Orbital there. Their space systems group, and that is primarily to help them with their satellite servicing capability. They publicly announced this capability earlier this year. You can probably go onto the Orbital ATK website and get some information about it. It's a very interesting concept where they're going to extend the life of GEO commercial communication satellites through sort of like a space logistics capability. Final Frontier Design, which is a very small firm in Brooklyn, New York. You don't really think of New York and Brooklyn as having space capabilities, but they do. And they're primarily focused on IVA suits, but they also have aspirations for EVA suits potentially in the future. So we're collaborating with them. And then finally, United Launch Alliance to help them develop new launch vehicle capabilities. Originally, it was focused more on the Vulcan launch vehicle, which they've announced as a follow-on to the Atlas and Delta EELVs. And more recently, we've become focused and helping them on their ACES upper stage development. So you can see a good mix here. I was really pleased when we selected these three companies, a good mix of types of companies and capabilities that they are developing, and we've been working with these companies since December of 2014 when they made the award. So I spent a lot of time on that because that sort of orients you to the kind of partnership that we eventually have with SpaceX now. So what late last year, as I said, SpaceX had this sort of broad corporate goal towards Mars, but in late 2015, they said, okay, now we've got a specific mission in mind. uncrewed technology demonstration mission to Mars using the Dragon spacecraft. They made an internal corporate commitment that they wanted to pursue this mission, and in doing so, they realized they could really utilize and benefit from from an expanded level of assistance from NASA. And I'll talk about each technical area in a minute. But they realized they could use much more support than just the portion of the few million dollars that I had for CCSC. So they approached NASA and asked for an expanded level of assistance in exchange for some information from the flight, and I'll talk a little bit about what each partner is getting. And so this was briefed to agency leadership back in October, and Steve Jurczyk, the Space Tech Mission Director at AA, was directed to form a small team. It's about a dozen people, led by Jim Ryder of STMD, and I facilitated that, and we had leaders from multiple centers, multiple mission directorates, and we conducted a feasibility study over a few-month period where we looked at the areas where SpaceX was requesting expanded assistance. We identified specific benefits to NASA, some cost estimates for what they were asking, and we did a top-level mission feasibility assessment as well, and briefed that to agency leadership, and they approved these additional areas. And, of course, the CCSC agreement was specifically designed for this kind of activity. So it was competitively awarded. It already existed. Its goal was Mars technologies and systems. So it fit the CCSC agreement actually perfectly. And so I was directed to expand that agreement to cover this additional level of support. And the additional funding was identified as well, and I'll talk a little bit about that. So we modified the agreement. That modification is also online in April, and I'll give you a little bit more about what's happened since then in some future slides. So now I'm on to slide 3, agreement and approach. This is the key thing. SpaceX is responsible for and is going to maintain control over the Red Dragon design, hardware, and operations all the way through flight and post-flight. NASA is only providing specific technical support. So this is where we get into what I call a consultant role, is the way I characterize it. And so we modded the agreement with these technical exchange documents. These are proprietary documents, so you won't see these online, but I'll give you a little bit of detail. There's 6 areas: deep space comm and Mars relay support, that's TED 1, deep space trajectory design and nav support. This is the key one, obviously, entry, descent, and landing systems engineering and analysis. Some aerosciences activities and databases, flight system technical review, and then, obviously, a big thing, planetary protection, consultation, and advice. And I have some more details on each one of these areas in a later slide. Nice. This doesn't cover everything that we're doing. These were just the specific expanded levels. We're also having discussions with SpaceX about potential payloads on the Dragon, and we've got a pretty significant ISRU community here at NASA, and we've had some technical interchanges with SpaceX about that, and they're being covered under the general broad CCS because SpaceX is interested in potentially hosting payloads and potentially long-term, obviously, they are going to want to do some ISRU. So we're already having some interactions with those two communities about that. And if you are a payload person and have some interest in maybe putting a payload onto this Red Dragon mission, I encourage you to get in touch with Dennis Stone or Warren Rummel. They're at JSC, and they are in the Capabilities for Commercial Space office down at JSC, helping execute these agreements for me, and get in touch with them if you have interest in any one of those areas. In return for our expanded level, we are receiving most of SpaceX's entry, descent, and landing flight data. This is a critical technology for us, and this is flight data that would not be available to us in any other means. I'll talk a little bit more about this on a future slide. As well as some other benefits that we're receiving from this. So this actually spans all of our mission directorates with the exception of aeronautics. HEO, my mission directorate, is responsible for managing the overall agreement and our overall partnership with SpaceX, all the six TEDs and the other. But we're also responsible for TED 1, the common tracking. That's in our SCAN division, Space Communications and Navigation division, and also through JPL, we are going to be providing those services. And then Space Tech Mission Directorate has, I would say, the largest role in this. They are leading TEDs 2 through 5 through JPL, JSC, and actually some other centers, more centers every day. And they are leading the technology demonstrator, mission design, and EDL, primarily covered under TEDs 2 through 5. That's where the real meat of this is happening. And then FMD is also involved through planetary protection support. That's TED 6, mostly through headquarters and some JPL support. We've got an executive committee that's made up of myself, Jim Ryder, and David Scherr. David's in FMD and Jim's in STMD. So we get together periodically to make sure we're staying on track. Again, this is a SpaceX-funded mission. Our support's mainly coming from people, as I said, civil service and JPL workforce is employed as needed. Generally not full-time. These are piecemeal of people when SpaceX needs support. We coordinate that and make sure that we can do that. There are some critical skills involved. Obviously, that, you know, NASA probably has the most experience of Mars than any organization on the planet, but they're not unlimited skills. And the feasibility determined that if there was any pinch points, that those would be manageable in looking at the missions that we have, like InSight and Mars 2020. We're also supporting some other non-NASA missions from international, some non-U.S. countries. So we took a look at that to make sure that we could actually perform what SpaceX was asking us to do. Just a couple other points. NASA's participation, the way SpaceX characterized it, was highly desired, but it's not enabling necessarily. I mean, SpaceX can do this. Our participation, we believe, will increase the likelihood that we'll be successful, and SpaceX believes that too, and that's why they asked for our support. But they could certainly do this eventually on their own, with the exception of the Deep Space Comm network. They obviously do not have deep space communications. There's never been a need for that. We've got that network, and it is available. And so with the exception of the Deep Space Comm, this is something that SpaceX could eventually do on its own. As I said, they are retaining ultimate authority regarding any design decisions and the ultimate risk assessment, acceptance of doing the mission or not. I would say a good way to characterize the way SpaceX looks is they like to get 80% of the answer sooner as opposed to 95%+ answer later. They've got a desire to get on with this and get as much information as possible as soon as possible. And the goal, you'll see, you know, there's the first mission opportunity in 2018, and then there's subsequent opportunities approximately every 26 months after that. SpaceX's goal is to increase their independence from NASA on each mission as fast as possible. So the heaviest reliance will obviously be on this initial mission, and then I think it's SpaceX's goal and NASA's goal for them to become increasingly independent to the point where they can eventually do these missions completely on their own. How fast that happens is completely TBD. We'll have to see, but I would suspect future campaigns to be potentially more independent as we go forward. So those were some key points I wanted to make. Let's see. So here's a very sort of gross graphic, not gross, it's sort of not refined, kind of a cartoon of the Red Dragon mission architecture. This is slide 4. Obviously, launch from Cape Canaveral. They're going to be using their Falcon 9 Heavy launch vehicle, which has yet to fly, but they're targeting first quarter of next year for the first flight of that Falcon 9 Heavy. This will be an FAA commercial licensed launch taken off from the Cape. There's no fairing. If you've seen the Dragon launches, they don't have a fairing, but they do have a nose cone. So after they get out of the atmosphere, they're going to jettison that nose cone, do the separation for the Mars transit orbit. They do this thermal roll, takes about 180 days to cruise. They jettison the trunk as they get close to Mars, and then they have the guidance, then the supersonic retropropulsion, which is their key technology, and then hopefully, fingers crossed, propulsive landing on the surface of Mars. And this is a key thing. Everybody asks me this. The primary mission objective, this is key, is to learn how to get to and land on Mars. If they do that, just that, this will be a huge success, I think, for SpaceX. I'll let them characterize it, but I think that's an accurate statement. They would like to do more, and hopefully they'll successfully land and be able to have a couple days of operation on the Mars surface. But really, they're really just looking for the data and a technology demonstration of this supersonic retropropulsion in the Mars atmosphere, seeing how that'll work, seeing how the Dragon potentially maneuvers or at least operates in the Mars atmosphere and potentially landing on Mars. So this is a SpaceX chart, as you can see from the bottom right, and that is the overall architecture. Okay, this is the next chart. Chart 5 is just a chart that I lifted from a HEO presentation that really shows you how difficult this is and why, in my opinion, we need the efforts of all of the U.S. capability, NASA and the private sector, if we're going to be successful in our journey to Mars. We're going to Mars as a nation. It's not just NASA's journey. It's a U.S.-led and even international journey, and we're going to need all of our capabilities to do that. So this chart shows historical missions to Mars by country. So the red lines, you got to look at the circles at the bottom. That really tells you the success and failure. If it's a green circle, it was a successful flight. If it's a red X at the bottom, then it was not successful. The red lines show Soviet Union missions, the blue are United States, and then you've got other colors representing Russian missions, Japanese, ESA, India. And if you look at those circles at the bottom, you can see a lot of red X's, right? We're all probably familiar with some of these failures. It's really hard to do Mars. And that's why we're going to need the efforts of both government and private sector to be successful. So we're looking at this collaboration in a very, very positive, cooperative light. And that's why we call these collaborations. I really think it fits that definition just perfectly. And I was really pleased that this fits so well into what our original thoughts were for these collaboration agreements. Next slide is chart 6. I'm going through fairly quickly, so if anybody has a question, feel free to chime in. Next chart is chart 6, and this is another HEO chart that describes some of the things that we are going to need to know and be able to demonstrate before human exploration of Mars is going to be feasible. Obviously, large mass payloads, 20 to 30 tons, our ability to land, we have gotten nowhere close to this. I think 1 ton is probably the high watermark for what we've landed on Mars. We're going to need to demonstrate multiple tons. The Dragon obviously is smaller than what we're going to need to do, but it's way bigger than anything we've done in the future. So getting that kind of data for a body re-entering into the Mars atmosphere and landing is obviously a key technology enabler for our overall Mars mission. Heavy mass, 130 tons total probably to do a mission, a very, very fast Earth reentry speed. You're going to be away from Earth. People are going to be away from Earth for a long period of time. You're going to have some reliable in-space transportation. You've got a very thin atmosphere. You've got communications blackouts and challenges associated with that, and then some ISRU challenges as well, oxygen and a lot of other stuff. So this just goes to show all the kinds of things that we're going to need if we're going to be successful in our journey to Mars. And the SpaceX mission we see as providing a key component of one of the things that we're going to need to know. So a little bit more about that is now chart 7. So big question that the feasibility study addressed were, you know, what are the benefits to NASA? This was a fairly big ask on the part of SpaceX from NASA. So we had to ensure that there were some, you know, this was in our interest and the government's interest as well. And so this is the slide that addresses that. I mean, we've got lots of policy documents, both the National Space Policy as well as congressional authorization, multiple Congressional Authorization Acts, and the original NASA Space Act as amended. There's various languages about support commercialization of space, support U.S. private industry. All those policy directives apply for this kind of collaboration and make it in NASA's, not only in our interest, but in our actual function. This is a NASA role to enable these types of capabilities to facilitate U.S. private sector endeavors and to help with the commercialization of space. There's obviously multiple documents, multiple policy directives that tell us to go do this. So it's not just a side thing. It's not just, us helping SpaceX. This is actually in-line mission function for NASA. The other key thing, and this is the real interest on the part of STMD, and they came, they're responsible for most of the FTE and had to identify most of the funding. This offers a flight demonstration of critical EDL technology, particularly the supersonic retropropulsion, at least a decade sooner and at a small fraction of the cost to NASA that it would be if we did our own kind of mission to get this data. We don't even have a mission on the books, so it's not even clear how long it would take, but certainly at least a decade. And this is at a very, very cost-effective way for us to get this kind of data. Every single candidate architecture, EDL architecture we have for Mars human exploration relies to some extent on supersonic retropropulsion. So this is a key first step for us. No other way to get it in the near term and at this kind of cost. So it was really a win-win, we thought, for both NASA and SpaceX and the nation for us to do this kind of collaboration.
Phil, I got a question.
Sure, go ahead.
Probably a good time to ask it here. You've been very articulate in describing the advantages to NASA. I happen to agree with them. The advantages to NASA in partnering with appropriate aerospace companies via the process you've been describing. And at the same time, you've also been articulate, although somewhat more brief, about the importance of international collaborations as well. What challenges have you faced so far, and how have you handled them with respect to ICAR restrictions?
Yeah.
I would guess they would be significant.
Well, so the agreement has several pages which talk about IP, intellectual property. It talks about the government's rights with respect to some of this data. We've made it clear that any science data that we get through this mission, that we will eventually put that out into the general international science community. That's obviously a key precept for science mission directorate, that any kind of science data that we get through any NASA activity be shared internationally. So we've got to be very careful with our ITAR, with any kind of mission. I would say we've been managing that to date. Since this is a SpaceX mission, not a NASA mission, they're primarily responsible for that. But any data that we get, we have to be very, very careful with, not only from the proprietary aspect, but also from the ITAR aspect. So we spent a lot of time on how the information would be marked, how it would be handled when it came into NASA, what information was coming into NASA, and the terms and conditions by which we handle that are all contained in the amendment to the agreement.
And how about planetary protection? Who certifies the planetary protection of these international agreements?
Yeah, so that's a great question. And I would say the paradigm for approving this mission is still somewhat immature. It's not necessarily NASA's role to approve that. It is a responsibility of the U.S. government. And so I think we are still working out the roles and responsibilities among the various agencies. So NASA does have a role. Since we're participating in it, there is an NPD that will guide some of our efforts. And we, primarily through this agreement, we are providing advice to SpaceX on how to sterilize their spacecraft, what kind of planetary protection provisions will apply, how they're going to get through those. And I would say, just in general, my answer to that is that that's an area that is still in development to some extent. But I think it's the FAA is going to have certainly going to have a role. Department of State is going to have a role, and NASA is going to have a big role too. This has never been done before, or even attempted before in this way. So we're charting new territory, and it's something that definitely has the attention of SpaceX and NASA. And we haven't identified any showstoppers, but we still have a long way to go in terms of what we're going to have to do to get government approval for this mission to fly.
Are there any international involvements in that planetary protection process?
You know, I'm not the expert on that. I think there would be, I don't know about involvement in the approval. That will probably come from the U.S. government, but we will have to substantiate that approval to some extent, I would think, to some international body. But I'm not sure. I'm just speculating. I'm not an expert in planetary protection.
This is Jim Head. Isn't it COSPAR that is the one that sets the rules over?
So I'm aware that there are some COSPAR guidelines associated with this. Their role in the planetary protection part of this is, I'm not sure. So I'm going to just punt on that question.
Gil, this is Gail. I can help a little bit.
Okay, go.
Hi, this is Gail Allen, and we have been working with the planetary protection officer on this, and we have a role not as approving their plan, but because we are participating as one of the partners in this, they have agreed to comply with our rules and regulations that we follow within our own missions. And that MPD, I can get you the number for that, that tells how that's laid out. But we're just more of an advisory role. But they have agreed to comply with our requirements.
Thanks, Gail. Let's see. I'm back on chart 7 now, unless there's some other questions. I hope not on that topic. Let's see. And one, two, three, fourth bullet enhances NASA's EDL capability. Every chance we get to go to Mars makes us smarter as well. So the fact that we are participating with SpaceX, we hope to gain some information in preparing our workforce for the challenges ahead for these significantly greater mass landings on Mars. Performance data on a large mass, large ballistic coefficient ever. That's what the Dragon will give us. Entry surface heating pressure. This will be a pretty well-instrumented Dragon, and so we'll be getting some good data from that. Entry guidance performance, how that Dragon performs, and particularly the supersonic retropropulsion performance and guidance during powered flight. And then ground surface interaction. Once it gets close to the ground, what happens with the rocket plumes and how that comes down to land, obviously that'll be key data for us. So these are all sort of benefits to NASA from our participation. They are going to be using their current Dragon V2 design or Crew Dragon design that they're using for both the ISS cargo and eventually crew missions. This is not a spacecraft that is capable of sending humans to Mars. So let's be clear about that. They're not going to be sending up any people in the Dragon to Mars by itself. That's not a mission that this spacecraft can do.
Hey, Phil, another question.
Yeah.
Are you suggesting any kind of specific instrumentation that they may or may not have already included?
Yeah, we're having ongoing discussions with them on that. And, you know, sometimes we'd like to see a sensor maybe in a different place than SpaceX was planning on putting a sensor. And so we make some suggestions along those lines about, you know, what might be beneficial. And all those decisions are really up for SpaceX since they have the design authority and the responsibility for the mission. So they're not under no obligation to take that guidance, but I have to say SpaceX has been very, very receptive to that kind of thing. They always have to balance that against their overall mission objectives and the success likelihood of getting this off, and this is an extremely aggressive timeline, as you can imagine. So they have to constantly make trades associated with mission success versus what they want to accomplish, but I've been very, very pleased with the partnership. SpaceX has been very receptive to all of our suggestions about the types of sensors that may go on that and even the locations of some of those sensors. This, we also had a, a lot of discussion through the feasibility study about the likelihood of success. And we did do a very, I would say, a fairly top-level assessment. We obviously didn't have detailed technical information about the mission to do like what I would call a normal detailed feasibility study. But we determined that there was a reasonable likelihood of success for this mission that would be increased with our participation. And Jim Ryder will tell you that they recognize that this mission might fail. I mean, our role is not to guarantee that SpaceX will be successful. It's explicitly acknowledged that it may fail at any point during the mission operations. And even with a possibility of failure, STMD and the overall NASA leadership felt like this was a good investment for us, recognizing that, you know, no mission is 100% successful, given what we thought were the risks and the schedule, very aggressive timeline. We still felt like even if it's not successful, this would be worthwhile for our participation. And as I said, we did look at the NASA assets and resources. There's a lot of competing interests for this, and felt like those conflicts could be manageable. As I said, nobody's full-time dedicated to this. If there was an instance where, you know, you had to make a choice between one or the other, obviously a NASA mission would come first. But we felt like we would, you know, we signed the agreement in good faith, felt like we could accomplish what is our responsibilities under this. Okay, on to slide 8, summary of NASA technical support. How are we doing on time? 3:40. Okay, going good. So the as I said, we put 6 technical agreements into as sort of annexes, as you might want to think about them, to the overall agreement. And this was, you know, even though the mission is a couple years away still, only a couple years away, less than a couple years away, these TEDs were acknowledged on both sides that we wanted to be somewhat flexible on this. This is where SpaceX thought that they would need the most support, and we documented those, and we made sure that we had resources available to provide these kinds of services. But I think we both acknowledged that as we get into this, and we're already seeing some of this, there's going to be some areas where SpaceX is going to realize that they need additional support. Maybe other areas we're like, I don't think we're going to need so much support there. So I expect these TEDs to probably get some degree of modification before we actually fly. We'll have to see. But the key point is that this was our initial set of support areas that we are going to provide, and there probably will be some ebb and flow as we go forward over the next 1.5 to 2 years. The first one, as I mentioned, is the HEO TED Deep Space Comm, and you'll see a lot of words in here, support, advice, consultation, coordination, and that's appropriate for our role. So we're going to support the SpaceX mission operations team through these Deep Space Comm, data relay tracking, using the Deep Space Network for a lot of that, provide prox links to the MRN service, telecommunications and tracking support. So you can just read these. This is the good level of detail about what we initially think that we'll be doing. TED 2, Deep Space Nav and Trajectory, support SpaceX's mission design, both the launch and the arrival phases through analysis and trade, help them with assessments on their cruise trajectories, and on through their in-flight navigation support, and potentially trajectory correction maneuvers. As we get closer, I foresee our interaction with SpaceX getting tighter and tighter on this area, as you can expect, as they have to do some trajectory tweaks as they go forward, and especially in the entry. I would expect us to be very closely aligned during that period, and particularly this entry, descent, and landing area in TED 3. We're going to provide a lot of our lessons learned. We're already doing that, review and advice. Very, very pleased with the level of interaction. The JPL people have been great. JSC people have been great. Everybody who's on the NASA side has been working on this. They really want to see this mission succeed. They're happy to provide this advice. SpaceX has really been pleased to get it. It's just been a very, very positive collaboration. I'm not saying we're not going to run into some hiccups. There might be some data discussions that we have that might be difficult. There might be some areas where we've got some pinch points and critical skills, so I'm not being Pollyanna-ish. We've got some difficulties ahead, but I'm just really pleased by the tone of the interactions and the fact that everybody is really trying to make this mission successful. Very, very pleased about that.
Are things in place where we could learn from processes or cultural things and bring them into NASA?
You know, I would say absolutely. That's one of the benefits we've seen through commercial crew. I've witnessed it both in cargo and crew. For crew, as you know, we have two FAR based contracts with Boeing and SpaceX, but we also have agreements with Sierra Nevada on their Dream Chaser space plane, as well as Blue Origin. All these companies have very different cultures. They're all doing human spaceflight, and they're all doing it a little bit differently. And so I think the benefit to the NASA workforce is seeing how there's multiple ways of doing things. Sometimes we get focused on one particular way and maybe get overly focused. It's got to be that way. You really see how there's a lot of ways to skin these cats, and the companies have a lot of innovative ideas. They bring experiences from other industries even, as well as other missions that they have done to apply to human spaceflight, and it enriches our workforce as well, not only seeing what's capable, but really seeing these innovations, seeing how the other companies address these problems. I have to say, you can't quantify it, but it definitely has been a benefit to our workforce through these collaborations, and I'm seeing it also here on this Mars mission as well.
Do you capture any of that formally, or is it just informal?
I would say so far we haven't made an effort to actually capture these kinds of lessons learned. But through these collaborations, when you're done, that's certainly something that we should be doing. We did it after COTS. There's a knowledge management website on the NASA website where there was a bunch of interviews done with the commercial cargo participants and what they thought was successful and what the kinds of things they learned. I expect to do something similar with commercial crew if and when we are successful. and we should certainly do that on this Mars Red Dragon mission, for sure.
That's great, thanks.
We're on the blocking and tackling, but yeah, as you step back, that's a great point. Okay, I'm on to slide 9, TED 4, Aerosciences Activities. I think this is one of the areas where we're going to provide, where we're going to get a lot of benefit, where we can take a lot of this data, feed them into our models and our aerosciences database that help refine mission design for future NASA missions. So this was a key area where we felt we would benefit, but also providing some of that expertise for SpaceX as well, helping with their characterization of ground and plume interactions, help enhance the value of their flight measurements. I mean, just on and on, you can see a fairly lengthy list of activities there. TED 5, Flight System Technical Review and Advice. This is related to TED 2, and we've had some discussions sometimes. You're like, oh, is that TED 2? Is that TED 5? Because this also has some comm aspects to it. But this is where we captured the flight systems comm activity. Review, advise, provide test support to the SpaceX director of telecom system development, help perform communications links and nav performance analysis, and maybe even help with some of their radios and transceivers. We'll see how that plays out in the future. And then we've mentioned this before, TED 6, planetary protection. They're already doing this. SpaceX already has a draft plan in development about how they're going to do this and what they're going to do to provide for planetary protection and to get the necessary government approvals to go do that. Okay, last slide. Where are we today? This is slide 10, status and next steps. Feasibility did its thing. I mentioned determined reasonable likelihood. I should have put that in quotes because that was the term that we came up with of mission success that would be enhanced with our expertise. We negotiated all the TEDs in the spring. Signed them, and then they are being implemented. We've since had two quarterly reviews. This is mostly management reviews. I would say we have daily, maybe daily, certainly weekly interaction between NASA and SpaceX on the on a technical level. And those activities happen on an ongoing basis, going very well. But then I wanted to make sure that we had a way to talk about the partnership. Whenever you have these kinds of partnerships, in my opinion, it is very critical to make sure that you have care and feeding of the partnership itself. You talk to the management team over there. We talk to our management. What's your expectations? What happened last quarter? How'd that work? Can we work a little bit better? Were there any issues with data? Were there any issues with people? What are we doing in the next quarter? Those are the things that we talk about every 3 months to make sure that we're on the same page. Partnerships are, it's critically important that you stay aligned with your partner when you have these kinds of agreements that are not necessarily traditional agreements where NASA is, you know, maybe has a cost-plus contract with a prime contractor. Those are perfectly good programmatic structures for difficult missions where you don't really know how much they're going to cost. Maybe your requirements are a little bit undefined. But when you've got a partnership where you're sharing technical risks and you're sharing financial resources, which is what we're doing here, you really got to spend some time making sure that you stay in alignment with your partners, or else you can really find yourself into a ditch. So we do that on a quarterly basis. We've had two of them already with SpaceX out in Hawthorne. And it also gives NASA, me, and the executive team a way to gauge SpaceX progress. If it looks like the mission is not making the kind of progress that we envisioned, there are some specific milestones that SpaceX needs to meet on an overall mission standpoint, because we are expending a lot of money on this. And if it looks like those resources are being, not necessarily good likelihood to success, then we'll have some discussions with SpaceX. You know, how are you doing on that, on the development of the spacecraft? You know, what's the testing look like? How are you doing? It gives us an assessment to make sure that SpaceX is staying on track to their overall schedule as well. And that way we can gauge our partnership. I have no concerns about that, but you do want to put some sort of external milestones to make sure everybody's on track and doing what they're supposed to be doing.
Hey, Phil, you mentioned shared risk. Can you elaborate on what risk NASA is exposed to?
Yeah, I would say, you know, obviously we're expending money on this. And so
beyond that.
Yeah, I would say just the opportunity risk of what our people are working on and not getting this actual data that we would really like to get. We're not in control of the mission. That's going to be SpaceX's call. So it's primarily the resources and financial and labor resources that we're committing towards this mission.
And maybe lost opportunities from doing other things.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, thanks.
This is Andy Gonzalez out of Ames. I'd like to know more about what the thinking is about SpaceX taking payloads along, even in the 2018 opportunity. Are they open to that, or they just
want to stay? No, they're definitely open to that, and we were already having some discussions with them. They're still at a fairly immature state. I mean, SpaceX is not quite exactly sure how much mass they're going to have available to the payloads. They're not exactly sure what kind of payload interfaces they're going to have, but they are definitely interested. We've got a preliminary list of payloads that we developed through the feasibility study, and since then, other groups have contacted the CCSC office down at JSC to investigate possible payloads. So I would say the answer is definitely yes. Whether or not they can be accommodated in the short period of time with the limited resources that SpaceX is going to have available, that's to be determined. But if you got some interest, contact Dennis or Warren, and we'll have some discussions.
I have been working with them quite a bit, but at one point, I think SpaceX said, okay, just kind of hold on for a second while we get our program going. Now, also, if there are payloads, you know, what would be the cost arrangement? Would NASA have to pay for the ride, or would SpaceX be able to say, as long as we're going, we can take effectively second payloads in the trunk or something?
Yeah, I would say all those terms and conditions have yet to be defined. I would expect there to be potentially some cost if SpaceX is going to be providing this kind of transportation, but That's not definite and to be determined.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, this is Chris from Langley. How does this flow to SpaceX's next generation Mars landing capability?
Could you repeat that? I'm sorry, you kind of broke up there in the beginning for me.
How does this agreement blend into SpaceX's next generation Mars landing capability?
Yeah, no idea. SpaceX has not shared their next generation concept and architecture with us. My understanding is Elon might make some sort of announcement at the IAC coming up soon, but don't know.
This is Dave from Goddard. Maybe to ask the obvious, if SpaceX is able to at least propose this much quicker and cheaper than NASA has on the books right now, was there any thought given to the agency considering to do this as an agency mission?
No, I would say not. SpaceX's initial target opportunity is 2018. So if we were going to do a mission in 2018 for supersonic retropropulsion technology demonstrator on in Mars atmosphere and on the surface of Mars, that would have had to have been thought of and proposed and approved many years ago. So this was the unique opportunity for NASA to partner on a mission that we could not otherwise do. Could we do one like this in the future? Sure, but we don't have one on the books right now. It's not funded, to my knowledge, hasn't even been proposed. So could we do it? Yeah. Is it in the books or in the pipeline? No. So this was a unique opportunity for us to, like I say, partner with SpaceX to do this. It was, like I said, I think a win-win for both us and them.
Thank you.
Hello, can you hear me? Hope you're doing well. I had a question. The benefit that you're talking about for NASA is, of course, the EDL data from this propulsive approach. So the data that NASA gets from this, when the time comes for NASA to do a Mars mission using this type of this technology or this approach, will probably compete that. I would guess if it's used even for a robotic mission or for a human landing, will the data that NASA gets from this be available to anybody that you contract with in those future missions?
Well, so there's two different things, Doug. First, good to hear from you. Glad you're doing well. So there's the technology and then there's the data. We're going to be getting the data associated, the sensor data, the flight data from this. The technology is going to be SpaceX. They have the IP. We have certain government purpose rights. I think that's the phrase that I use, government purpose rights, to use the flight data internally to NASA. And then if in the future, just like you said, if we had the need for this in one of the NASA missions, we'd compete it and private industry would propose their various solutions using their technology. So I think that's the way it would play out.
But they would have the benefit of your expertise as you partner with them on a mission?
On this one?
No. What you learn, what you learn from this approach, I don't know how to call it technology, but you're going to get an understanding of how propulsive retrograde, works and you'll update models and that sort of thing. So, will that be something that you share with a partner? You see where I'm going? Or do they have to develop it all themselves?
If I can jump in, this is Andy again. For example, what's the landed mass capability to the surface? that'd be the key parameter. Can you land, you know, can you land 100 kilograms, 1,000 kilograms, to whatever altitude? And I'm thinking about that.
Things you're going to learn are, you're creating a bow wave with propulsion, and you know how the temperatures go through that bow wave and what the effects of are of on the vehicle to get, you know, get more specific.
Right.
So is that all proprietary to SpaceX? Or how does NASA then use that for a mission if it's competing and ends up with, you know, it could be a SpaceX, it could be somebody else on a future mission?
Yeah, so I would say we would not, you know, any sort of data that we get, again, is we have some government purpose rights, and I do not believe that we would be sharing that with other companies. And particularly the SpaceX technology, you know, obviously their systems and their hardware, that's all going to be proprietary to SpaceX.
Sure, sure that is. I'm just talking about the expertise to be able to do that type of an entry. Or is every company going to have to go duplicate what SpaceX did in order to be able to compete in for that contract, say? And that might be another way to put it.
Yeah. So I wish I had a lawyer on the line, Doug, because they sort of hashed out those details in pretty good detail to make sure that SpaceX's interests were protected, but also that the government got the rights to the data that we needed. So I'm not quite sure how to answer that specific question.
Because if the only beneficiary on the knowledge, and I understand the proprietary hardware and all that, but if the only beneficiary of the knowledge to do this type of entry goes to the government and it can't share it, then I don't know how you compete it on a future mission.
This is Dave Schumann. I'm one lawyer on the line. I didn't work these particular agreements, but I think the speaker said the agreements themselves are online and the IP provisions should be public in terms of who gets what and what's available for dissemination in the future.
That's correct. All the terms and conditions and the IP and data rights are all there. So if you speak governmentese, you can read those, or legalese, lawyerese, you can read those, and maybe that'll help you, Doug, answer that question. I just don't want to say, I don't want to be too specific on that because I might mislead you.
Okay, I understand. I appreciate it.
Phil, this is Dan Adamo. I'd like to ask a related question that might clarify this. You during your presentation indicated that effectively the scientific data would be entering the public domain, that even international partners would have access. Would the same be true of the flight data? In other words, the trajectory data during EDL?
No, absolutely not. That would not have the same dissemination requirements associated with it. That's the key data. That's some of the key data.
Okay, thanks.
This is Harley. We're just about a minute and a half past our normal quitting time. We own this line 24/7. If Phil is willing to hang on a while longer, it's up to Phil how much longer the Q&A can continue. So, Phil, your schedule determines when we ring off.
Yeah, I can take, let's say, two or three more questions.
Sounds good. Okay, folks, so you have more questions.
Yeah, hi. This is Larry Kuznets out in Berkeley. Hey there, Phil.
Hi.
Hey, Harley. Hey, I had a question that occurs to me. You know the old expression, those who ignore history are doomed to repeat it? Well, I mean, I've heard a lot of stuff about planetary protection, but I haven't heard anybody reference the effort that was made during Project Apollo. And the millions and millions of dollars that was spent creating a building for planetary protection. I haven't heard Penny Boston's name mentioned. She's the chief of astrobiology at NASA, and this falls under her purview, or Margaret Case, who basically wrote the book on planetary protection. That's only one aspect of this redundancy. and reinventing the wheel that I seem to hear a lot. For instance, spacesuits. There are multiple people working on spacesuits with multiple designs, but there's no overriding organization that's actually sifting these through to a plan that's going to make any sense and coalesce within 10 years, which is probably when you're going to need it. Also, there are multiple groups doing simulations, Mars analog simulations. They're all over the map. And while I appreciate what you said about NASA learning about different partners doing different things, at some point somebody's going to be, you know, there's too many chefs in the kitchen. All this stuff is going around and around and around. And where is it focusing? Who's actually in charge? When I say who's in charge, one of the things that I haven't heard anybody mentioned is what kind of benefit of NASA participating in the Red Dragon mission is going to accrue to SLS? Don't you think people who are in the funding line of SLS are going to look and see, hey, these guys have done a great job. What do we need SLS for? There's already gigantic pressure on SLS right now for funding. And here we are, you know, supporting and jumping into that. And just by way of one last example, the EM-1 mission around the moon that's proposed for 2018, there was myself and some other guys submitted to Bill Gerstenmaier a plan to actually convert EM-1 instead of going around the moon to actually go around Mars and do a reentry on Earth to take a look at the Orion heat shield. And by the way, to carry what kind of sensors would you want to carry to Mars in Orion that might benefit this kind of thing? Well, you know, it seems to me all this stuff should be known when you talk about, a mission architecture. All of these things should be under the purview of somebody. And for NASA to say, well, this guy's involved and that guy's involved. Well, so many people are involved that it ends up being, you know, I'll give you one ludicrous example. We had guys out at Ames Research Center designing a hard spacesuit for 20, 30 years trying to make a dent in what JSC was doing in their spacesuit. Well, the only thing that ever occurred out of that was anger between centers and individuals. And, you know, when you find the same thing that's happening with simulations and the same thing, analog simulations on the ground, and the same thing that's happening with different mission architectures, and here's SLS whirling away in the background trying to get funded, it leaves me with a lot of insecurity about the direction that this program's going. Because it sounds great when you put up 8 or 9 charts, but the reality is this has been done in the past, and how much effort is really being put into understanding the ramifications of the future based on what we already know. That's my 2 cents on this.
So I'm not sure if there was a question in there, but
I'm looking for a comment, not a question.
Okay, so I would say that this has never been done before. Putting a large mass into the Mars atmosphere using supersonic retropropulsion, I do not believe that's ever been done before. So this is a unique opportunity, and it's a piece of the overall puzzle. You know, I would sort of question the premise of your comment in that I think redundancy, multiple capabilities to do even the same thing, I see that as a feature, not a bug. We see that with
nobody's arguing. Nobody's arguing.
Hang on, you had your chance to talk. Now let me respond. We've seen with crew and cargo, particularly cargo to the ISS, a system goes down. Some of those other systems are still available. They do the same thing. That is a strength of the U.S. space program, that we have multiple ways to get cargo to the space station. I don't believe in having one uber czar in charge of a specific technology or a specific capability. I think it's a benefit when we have multiple capabilities. They all do something a little bit different, and we can utilize those going forward. If NASA has a mission, we can choose which one of those capabilities makes sense for us. And even with spacesuits, I think it's a benefit that we have multiple spacesuits that can do similar but not necessarily the same things. And with respect to commercial crew, SpaceX is pursuing their spacesuit architecture. Boeing is pursuing a different architecture. And we've got a different spacesuit set of requirements and capabilities through our Orion capability and our deep space exploration. I see those all as strengths, and I don't necessarily think it would be a benefit to have one Uber czar in charge of all that. We're, like I said, we're going to Mars as a nation. We're going to need the expertise of both the government and the private sector to do that. And so that's what I would say. And SLS has got its own unique mission. It's very, it's a difficult mission. It's going to be one of the biggest launch vehicle ever built, and we're going to need that capability if we're going to go to deep space exploration. And I think SLS is doing well, knocking down their milestones. Obviously, funding is always an issue for all government programs, but it's making good progress. So that would be my comment.
Okay, well, how about one last question? Thank you both, guys. How about one last question for Phil? Anybody want one? Okay, Phil, thank you so much. It was an outstanding presentation. Judging from the questions alone, these are important topics, and you have significant followers. We all are, I think, looking forward to what Elon Musk is going to be presenting. I think it's early afternoon East Coast time next Tuesday. Take care. Talk to you all next week at next week's positive.